I'm Frank Chadwick. You were saying, hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank. Hi, Frank.
And I'm a game designer. We're here to talk today about the miniatures rules, the science fiction miniatures rules, Striker, which were not published 20 years ago, but actually published, which I didn't know, 30 years ago. Man, that's a long time. And what I thought I'd talk about is kind of two things. The first thing I want to talk about is how the future has changed in 30 years. Not how the world, but how the future has changed. What we think of as the future. So kind of what 30 years ago I was seeing happening in an attempt to project forward into what was going to be going on in warfare, and then how that differs from what we have to, you know, how we think of the future of warfare today. The most striking thing is that in 30 years, for small unit action, for infantry actions, there have been no important changes in personal weaponry. I mean, there's been some minor refinements around the edges, but it's basically the same. I mean, still using it. Now, the M16 is hardly recognizable from 30 years ago, but it's still basically an M16. M16 has been in service longer than any other service rifle in the history of the United States, which really made my business partner, Glenn Kidd, feel old when he discovered that, because he'd been in the Army and never got an M16. And all he saw was an M14, you know. The longest service rifle in our history came in after he was in the Army. Oh, great. that's really interesting, that there's been no major advance in weaponry. And I think I understand why, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But where have the advances been? Detection is where a lot of the, you know, a lot of the, I mean, today, what guys, where they have, everybody's got night vision. Everybody's got night vision or enhanced visibility. So there's been a lot of, at the individual soldier level, and all the way up to JSTARS and orbital satellites and surveillance stuff. I mean, there's been an enormous amount of resources invested in better detection and identifying the enemy on the battlefield. We anticipated that to an extent in Striker, and we talked about some of the efforts to thwart that in terms of chameleon suits and things like that. And there hasn't been as much countermeasures done as we anticipated. And if I forget, remind me to come back to this as to why. Some of the things that we talk about in terms of personal body armor and personal cloaking devices haven't really become the norm. But the first thing is detection. Lots of work in detection. The second thing is data transmission and processing. You know, boy, we have in Striker, those of you who remember, we have this thing called the map box, which is this big clunky thing that you unfold that has all this electronic mapping stuff on it. Well, now, you know, everybody's got iPhones. That's the map box. You know, so 30 years ago, I certainly missed where that was going, but, you know, it would be the, back then it would have been like saying everybody's got a Dick Tracy two-way wrist radio. But there's, you know, data transmission and processing, really important, and a lot of stuff's been done on that. Communication, a lot of stuff done on communication, and I think on a small unit scale, we were pretty close to nailing that. The level of communication right now at the small unit level is about what we postulate in kind of the mid-future tech levels in Striker. Elite units have much better communication. I don't know how many of you have read Black Hawk Down or read much about the fighting in Mogadishu in that period, but you had this mixed group. The main people who were doing the fighting was a mixed group of Rangers and Delta Force, and the Delta Force guys just went right through the town. And the Rangers were lagging behind because every time the Rangers came to an intersection, they kind of had to hold up, look, check out the intersection, you know, cover it and everything. And the Delta Force guys all had individual headsets, were all on the same radio net. And so one guy's ahead and said, it's clear, And everybody in the unit knows that. And they were just going through these intersections when they were clear. And the Rangers really suffered from not having that level of communication. To the point that eventually you end up with kind of Rangers, little gaggles of Rangers around Delta Force guys, because they've got the headsets and they're, you know, they're linked into everything. So, you know, communication is one of the things that's changed. Situational awareness. There's a lot of work. I mean, I didn't anticipate GPS. The map box anticipates some of the stuff like integrating satellite photos and stuff like that. But man, I really didn't see GPS coming and the enormous impact it ended up having on the ability to electronically, precisely locate exactly where you are. And even some of that, the Army is still, I mean, that's a revolutionary technology that the Army's still integrating. It still hasn't completely, I mean, it's still not a completely mature technology in terms of being completely mined. You know, we're still talking about, instead of actually doing, we're still talking about the guy that commanded 3rd Armored Division in Gulf War I, really interesting guy too. Really like him.
Franks or
what's that?
Not Franks.
Not Franks. Freddie Franks was a 7th Corps commander. This was one of his division guys. The guy that commanded the 3rd Armored Division. Well, anyway, it'll come to me or not. But he ended up then going on to train at the Armor School. And a number of years ago, he said that we were right on the verge of indirect fire arriving on target as quickly as direct fire. That in terms, because the main difference in delay would be how far the round had to come. But in terms of identifying the target and targeting and giving the order to fire, indirect fire was getting almost as fast as direct fire. And it's largely because of things like GPS. The GPS, in theory, you can have a screen that has, that if you have a, in a tank, if the turret is pointing a certain direction, your onboard computer knows that. You have a laser range finder, so it knows exactly how far it is to what you're lasing. It knows where you are from GPS, therefore it knows exactly where it is. And the artillery system knows exactly where it is because of its GPS. And so that makes the solution of this target problem trivial. You know, I mean, really, I mean, it just solves all the problems. People, and you also know the exact elevations and things like that. That's a big problem in artillery is relative elevation. But if you've got a GPS and you've got a good ground survey, you know the difference in elevation as well. So the targeting solution just becomes click. You know, here's your charge setting. Here's here's your mills and all that sort of stuff. So you just punch that in, and boom, rounds down range. And it's not significantly slower if all that stuff works than direct fire. And that's something that's really revolutionary. When it actually comes to be, I mean, it's still more of a promise than a reality. We're running into, I know the digital brigade ran into some problems with bandwidth crowding. And there's also some problems that have been with us for a long time in terms of the overload of the user. That you can process more information and display more information than a guy can kind of grok. And that's a problem for fighter pilots. I've talked to guys who said, some Vietnam Air Force veterans who were talking about being in a dogfight, and with all the growlers going, you know, because one of the ways that you know when your sidewinders have a target is they growl. And that's kind of but with the growlers going and the beepers going and the alarms going for being targeted and everything else, this one guy didn't hear the fact that his wingman is yelling, "There is a MiG on your tail," you know, just didn't hear it. And he was convinced the guy hadn't told him when they got back. Actually, it was Navy because he got back to a carrier. They played him. You know, they actually had to play him the recording of the thing. And his wingman was telling him, "There's a MiG on your toes and MiG on your tail." And it's really easy to get overloaded. You know, we can process so much stuff. And so there's kind of the choke point on all this technology stuff really becomes the soldier. And so that's why the, so I would say that's, and that's kind of the second part of this, and that is where the one of the real interesting changes has been is a recognition, a clearer recognition, we always kind of know, but a clearer recognition that the choke point, the critical element is the soldier. And I think one of the reasons that personal protection and personal cloaking and all this stuff has been, improvements have been marginal, is because it degrades the soldier's ability to do his job, which is carry a whole bunch of stuff for a long time and stay physically, you know, alert, a reserve of energy and some mental alertness. That's really what a soldier does. And if you load him up with stuff that's a lot of extra body armor or a suit that protects him from IR signature by keeping it all in, making him hot and sweaty, he's just not going to be able to do his job as well. You've really got to work hard to not do anything that will make this guy begin experiencing more fatigue than he's going to anyway in the normal course of doing this incredibly difficult thing that he's doing. So what we've done, one of the things we have done in the last 30 years is dramatically and pretty scientifically look at physical conditioning. The U.S. Army has gotten real serious about physical conditioning. It's not to say there aren't still some people who are not in good condition, but for the most part, the U.S. Army today is in much better shape than it's ever been in history. The standard of physical conditioning for basic riflemen today is higher than the standards for special forces in Vietnam. And that makes an enormous difference in terms of how a unit performs, because an infantryman's got to carry his weapon, his ammunition, and all this other crap with him. And he's got to do it for a long time, and when he gets there, he's got to be able to function in combat, and when the combat's done, keep moving if you want to keep exploiting a situation instead of just sitting down exhausted at the end of it. And the U.S. Army today is really capable of doing that, like I don't think any army ever in history has been. There's this great blog, maybe some of you have read it, but it was a blog by a French soldier who was in Afghanistan. And he was in a civic action unit, and there was a co-located with an American unit. He's talking about, boy, these Americans are really big guys. You know, these just giant muscle, you know, muscle guys who carry all this stuff and they run everywhere they go. And whenever we get in trouble, you know, we're out driving around, we get in trouble, and bam, the Americans are like right there, you know, to get us out of trouble. I mean, it's just this, you know, he said, we feel like little wimpy guys compared to them. And he talks about how he says, the Americans, when they're on guard duty, you know, when they're on observation post, they have an observation post up there, and it's like a 6-hour shift. He says, they don't move. They just sit there and look for like 6 hours. So, really, interesting from a foreign point of view of the U.S. Army and a NATO, you know, not a third world army, you know, pretty good. You know, France has got the fourth largest military expenditure in the world. They're the fourth largest army in terms of expenditure and force structure and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, they're not nothing, you know. So it's interesting how much the emphasis has been not on weaponry, because the truth is, if you poke a hole with someone, they're going to bleed out and die. And a rifle is a pretty good way to poke a hole at someone. And you don't have to get much more sophisticated than that. You know, the issue is getting the guy in a position to do it, keeping him alert mentally, keeping him informed without overloading him. And that's, you know, all the physical conditioning we've been doing, and also the very, very, very realistic training has made a huge difference. We put a lot of emphasis on realistic training. This is kind of the first half of, maybe more than the first half, but the first part of what I want to talk about is kind of what's happened in warfare that was anticipated and what wasn't. You want to talk about that a little bit before I want to talk a little bit about game design, too. We'll talk about that in a minute. But any questions or...
Yeah,
observations about this stuff?
Frank, you were relating some of this stuff to Stryker, and where you were right, where you were off, and so forth. Can you summarize that? Because I lost track where...
Well, Stryker spent a lot of time talking about weaponry. But that's a game, and it's a science fiction game, and so, you know, it's cool to talk about that. You know, lasers and Gauss rifles and everything. I invented the term Gauss rifle, by the way.
So I blame you.
Yes. Yeah. Blame me. Yeah, that's all of it.
But or cite you. Actually, cite you is the best, better term.
Yeah, you can cite me. Or blame. I think there is actually an online article that does cite it, but the first use of it ever was in the supplement Mercenary. That's the first use of the term Gauss rifle. And I invented it because we needed a term that didn't sound dorky. I mean, who's going to call somebody an electromagnetic linear accelerator, right? Blah, 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 you know? Yeah, it's so Gauss. It's magnetic Gauss. Gauss rifle.
Well, what I meant, though, was...
But, okay.
When you were reading back then, I mean, obviously, as we get older, we were talking about this, that our perspective and how we read things changes. I mean, as you get older, you can read the same book that you read 30 years ago, but it's like, oh my God, why didn't I see that then, right? So what I'm getting at here is a summary of 30 years ago, you were designing Stryker, you were putting these things into it from the readings and everything. You now know what's changed and what hasn't. I want a summary here. I'd like to know your perspective on what you did and whether you feel like, you know, this is standing up. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a sense that Stryker was pretty good analysis back then, even if there were things that didn't develop quite the way you were expecting. You know, because that's what impressed me about what you did.
Yeah, the emphasis on for all the technology in Stryker, the emphasis on Stryker really is on command control and controlling the battlefield and controlling troops in the battlefield. I mean, that's really what Stryker is all about. And that, I think, I'm not sure mechanically I'd do it the same way today, but in terms of the theoretical way it works, I mean, I think there's easier ways to do it. And after 30 years, I've probably figured out some, you know, a little less mechanically cumbersome ways of doing it. If that, I've wasted 30 years. If I haven't learned anything about how to do this stuff in the last 30 years. But I think the theoretical approach of what we did in Stryker is I think really right on the money.
Yes.
And I don't think that the science fiction is going to change that much. And I had a lot of pushback when I was doing it, and I was from some of my playtesters, you know, guys who just who didn't want to have any command and control. They wanted to be able to have their guys do everything, you know. And this is ridiculous that it takes this long for a platoon leader to change the orders to get a platoon. And I had this guy explain to me why it was ridiculous that it took this long. And when he got done explaining it, I said, you realize you've taken longer making this argument than in the game the platoon leader has to make this change, you know? I mean, we want to say, do this, 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 and everybody will do it. No, 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 no. No. You've got to explain, you know, they put a real premium on planning. Detailed planning of what you're going to do, and if you go off, and if you can figure out the plan that will get you there, you're way ahead. But when the wheels come off the wagon, it's really, really hard to get to get guys to change what they're doing because they're full of adrenaline and everything else. People are shooting at them, trying to kill them. They're it's noisy and loud, and you can't say, "No, guys, here's what we're going to do." You know.
Well, that's why I wanted you to stop and say that, because what's impressive about Frank is the fact that I've always appreciated the fact that when he analyzes something, and like I mentioned earlier, there are game designers, and some of them are terrific game designers, and they make great games, but the games have nothing to do with reality. And the one thing that both Frank and I share, not only our love of history, but also in the reality is, what's really happening here? What are the key factors? And the reason I think Stryker and all of your stuff stands up is because you analyzed how do things really work? How does this impact and where does it go? Which is why Stryker, even if it was off on the weapons, the fact is it's a sound design that the emphasis on command and control is exactly what's happened 30 years later, right? And all the other games that you're doing, whether it's this Men Under Fire or the other things, teach you how does it actually work. So you're playing real history or real warfare. That's what impressed me about Stryker. I mean, if somebody picked that up, 30-year-old rules, would be more accurate than a lot of the games that are out there right now.
Well, that's a current set of arguments amongst games right now, is how to institute command and control. You know, get that feel on the table.
But you have to understand, it's not a game mechanic problem. It's an understanding of warfare and having read a variety of things.
Exactly.
When Frank sits there and tells you about a World War II incident and how things and how that related to the 30s and this theory and then what they're doing in the Gulf War, Frank is picking things all over the place, you know, to...
I got that. Actually, I was giggling mostly as having the argument about explaining to somebody you're trying to play the game.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Why this exists were there, but they're saying, no, you should be able... It's like,
yeah.
It goes at the speed of light. Who
hasn't had that argument, playing the game, who hasn't had that argument with somebody?
And one thing that I will give anybody who feels that way is that if that's the game they want to play, that's okay, because we're playing games first to have fun. Okay? First thing, that's why it's called a game. You know, we're playing this to have fun. Not, and for a lot of us, learning something is part of the fun. But if that's not part of the fun, then play a game that you have fun with. I mean, you don't got to play this. You don't got to play games like this. But if you enjoy learning stuff about it, then, that's the kind of game I like to do. I will say one of the coolest things anybody said when Stryker came out was I got a letter from a guy. And you guys have all played Stryker. You know all about all the tech levels and everything. And the guy said, this is the game I have been waiting for 10 years. This is the first game that has enabled me to do what I've always wanted to do, which is 30 years war skirmish. He was absolutely serious. He used Stryker for 30, it's just low tech level. 30 years war skirmish. Uh-huh.
You have archaic weapons in there.
Yeah. Yeah, you got the archaic weapons. Huh?
And, yeah, it's still all about shouting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, we played World War One.
Did you keep some of the things in Stryker that they've shown up in Men Under Fire?
The Men Under Fire is really a different kind of game. Men Under Fire is not... Men Under Fire teaches tactics, but it's not really teaching the problem of the squad and platoon levels command. I mean, it's almost a given in Men Under Fire that you're going to be able to overcome that. That's not really what the game's about. You can argue that it ought to be, but it can't be about everything. I mean, Men Under Fire is about just about how tactics works, assuming that you can actually get your guys to do what you want them to do. That part of that's not the game that Men Under Fire is. So I don't know if that answers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, you need to play it. We'll play it sometime. And it's a completely different game, but it's other things to look at other than just that aspect of command control.
Well, I actually have a question regarding that, because I have a theory about games, and I think that games are very much like books, and you cannot cover everything in the book. I mean, life is too complicated, so you have to pick what story you're going to tell. You have to decide.
That's exactly
what
right.
Am I, and therefore,
you kind of have to have a narrative, at least in your own. You have to have voices in
right.
your own head.
So part of this is what scale of game you're going to have, what the hex sizes are going to be, what the unit counter size is going to be, and so forth. But there's also, what am I trying to show here? Who is the game player? Is he a division commander, a core commander, and so forth? What is it I'm trying to show? The friction of combat?
And Men Under Fire is about tactics. And Stryker is about control.
Okay.
It is about leadership.
I got that sense.
If I were to differentiate between what the focus is, I mean, Stryker is really about leadership and the problems that you... Because Stryker, in a sense, really is a role-playing game. Yeah, you know where where the rules are on command are how all the NPCs work, which is all the little soldiers other than you, the commander. You know, now you can end up playing as a couple different commanders, but basically what it's kind of a solitaire system to run all the NPCs in the platoon and or not run them. You know, So that's really what Striker's about, is getting those guys to, you know, what it takes to get those guys to do what they're supposed to do. And Men Under Fire is more about the actual, some basic tactical principles at the small unit level, like fire maneuver and suppression and stuff like that, and how to make all, put all that stuff together. And there's a lot of stuff in Men Under Fire to keep you off balance. And this isn't Men Under Fire, but you every game you start by drawing, there's like a certain number of mission cards, and you draw a mission, each side draws a mission card. And that'll tell you when your army is divided into three forces, and when you deploy one force or maybe two on the board, and it tells you when the others come in. And you don't know what the other guy's got. And some of these cards are flank attacks. I mean, you don't have to come on your base line. You can come on the, you can turn a flank based upon the card. Or you can have ambushes, right? There's all these things that, and when the guys were playing, we just ran a game earlier today. And, I mean, and before the game, they said, don't you have provisions for, you know, orders not going right and people screwing things up? No, don't worry about it. You know, by the middle of the game, they're just, whoa, what's, you know, everything's going wrong because we've got their plan here, and all of a sudden there's this U.S. a British armor coming around their left flank, but then the Americans do a double, the British do a double envelopment, and there's a Panther that appears out of ambush there and is shooting up, and every, you know, by the time it's done, everybody's kind of going, yeah, okay, that's, you know, that was a pretty chaotic experience. So for a kind of a programmed, not where you don't need a referee system, it's definitely a very tactically rich game and full of surprises, and every game's going to play differently. And so that's kind of what Men Under Fire is about, and that's not really what Striker's about. Striker is not as well-defined a situation. It has to be more open-ended to play all the campaign stuff and all the different stuff that went with the traveler role-playing game.
Right. It's a different game.
Yeah.
It's a different theory and a different presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get is the difference here, emphasizing that even though it's still very valid and a lot of the things you wrote 30 years ago have, in fact, if you want to say, come true, mm-hmm. right? And basically confirmed a lot of your assumptions, right? You've got a new game that's a totally different approach.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that really does deal with some different stuff.
Okay.
What do I got here about... Actually, we've already kind of talked about the game design stuff with the you kind of, so the stuff I was going to talk about game design is currently already covered too. What do you guys think? What are your thoughts on it? What other questions do you got for me?
Well, you said to remind you about the cloaking device.
Well, yes, but I already did that. That's the whole issue with physical conditioning. The reason that we don't have more body armor.
You can't carry as much.
You can't carry as much stuff, and like anything that keeps in your thermal signature is going to, you know, burn the soldier up.
Yeah. Right.
It's really tough. It's really tough to. You have to make some really hard decisions. Really hard decisions about what that soldier is going to carry, and I think we've done one of our decisions is everything. So we got to make bigger soldiers. We've been actually doing pretty good at that. Making starker gunners, you know, great big guys. So we're pretty good at that. And but also we do a lot of hard decisions about just how much stuff a guy can carry, and what it is, you know, what it is you're going to give him. I mean, would you rather give him? You've got to give him a good night vision device. You've got to, but you know. How many clips of 5.56 ammunition, how many magazines is he going to leave home to have this gadget? You know? Because, boy, you want to carry as much ammunition as you can. Yes?
Well, this is actually going to one of the circular arguments about Striker and Traveler Universe Valley, about the nature of what is battle dress. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the fan base, we go from some of us who it's just combat armor that you don't have to carry to other people who think it's the super suit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to assume that you're on the lower end. It's like, okay, the soldier doesn't have to carry this armor, so he can carry night vision.
I think that's really the approach I took with what we called combat armor, as opposed to battle dress. Combat armor is pretty heavy armor you don't have to carry.
Okay, so...
But battle dress is powered armor, is real powered armor. And it with a lot of load-carrying ability built into it. At least that's the way Mark always defined it. You know.
I remember that differential. Mm-hmm. Combat armor was supposed to have some power, but only enough to maybe get some.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's rigid armor that doesn't weigh you down because it's whatever it hit. But yeah, battle dress by Mark's definition always was basically Starship Trooper stuff.
Yeah. Now, another factor I was wondering if you were thinking might factor into the lack of camouflage and stealth tech is the increasing tendency towards asymmetrical warfare.
Oh, I think absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we don't really have an example of equal tech forces at the high end fighting each other in a long time. I mean, you really can't count the first Gulf War. You know, there's just not much. Even though Iraq has stuff that's almost modern at the time, the best of their stuff is Soviet stuff, and Soviet stuff just wasn't as good as the West European stuff. I mean, you don't really have an example of two real high tech, say Western European countries fighting, and what happens when they do. And we can speculate about, but that's all it is. And I don't really trust the speculation very much. I don't know that I can speculate. I don't know that I trust my own speculation. I mean, I know that in the 70s and early 80s, there was all this talk about what the first battle of the next war is going to be like, and there's all these calculations that this is going to be the kill ratio, and so like in 2 or 3 weeks, everybody's going to run out of ammunition and tanks and men and everything else, and the war's going to just can't sustain itself. And this is exactly what Tukhachevsky said in the 1930s about what World War II is going to be like. Exactly. You know? And at the same time, there's this guy named Svechin, who is this other major theorist in the Soviet Union, who said, Tukhachevsky's just full of shit. The next war is not going to be short, it's going to be really long. And it's not going to be won in the first months. It's going to be won after years. And it's going to be won by the nation that can marshal its industrial power for the long haul. Because, he said, and I think this is a real insight that is as good today as it was then, armies are fragile. Nations are robust. All these things that you can do on the tactical level to disrupt a unit, you can't easily do to a nation state. So, yeah, you can bang up armies and stuff on the frontier, but if the nation has any sort of strategic depth, you just can't put it down that quickly, unless the nation's ready to go on its own. And World War II kind of bears that out. You know, there's a couple of countries that go because they're ready. France is ready to go anyway. The Germans can't put the Soviets on the map. And we have a hell of a time putting the Germans on the map. Basically, you've got to end up outproducing them and attriting them and going into their basements and dragging them out by the shirt, and putting them in jail. I mean, it's enormously difficult to figure out what it takes to make a country quit. We never figure it out with North Vietnam. We never figure out what are you going to do to make a country quit? What are you going to do to make the Taliban quit? We have enormous technology, but in terms of strategic wisdom, we're not much further ahead than we were a couple hundred years ago in terms of really understanding. I mean, the easy thing about this is why I don't really like strategic games. I'm doing a series of strategic games for Victory Point Games now. But it was some trepidation. I mean, I always toyed with the idea, but the problem with a strategic game is we have to write victory conditions. And when the victory conditions are written down, the problem becomes trivial. The real game at the strategic level is figuring out what the victory conditions are. You know, that's where everybody goes off the track, is they can't figure out the victory conditions. If someone had written down the victory conditions for the Vietnam War, yeah, we can do that. You know, just tell us what it is we got to do. Instead, we're flying around. Well, what if we bomb all their cities? Well, that didn't work. Well, what if we do this? Well, that didn't work. I go around and around with Air Force guys who talk about the Air Force as this great strategic weapon. We can hit any target. We can neutralize any target. Yeah, but what targets does it take to end the war? We don't know that. And I know this is getting a little far from the start, but maybe getting back to it a little bit, the drone missions in Afghanistan are a great example of this. We get so good on intelligence that we could identify Taliban leaders, send in unmanned drones, and kill them. Wow, okay? And what was the result? A new generation of Taliban leaders who were crazier. and I mean, some of them really crazy. At one point, Mullah Omar wanted to have this one area damp down the fighting because the U.S. was putting troops in the area and he didn't want these guys fighting. These guys were just attacking anyway. So he sent a cleric in to really read in the riot act, and they killed him. You know, whoa, what? all these unintended consequences of achieving, you know, this, you know, okay, we figured out what we're going to do. We're going to kill that other leadership. Okay, that didn't work. or at least not the way we intended. Strategic games, I think, are fraught with peril. You had the same argument. We're really getting far afield, I know, but at least the unmanned drones are getting back to Stryker. But back in the Civil War, there was this argument: How do you defeat the South? What is it going to take to get the South to quit? Well, the Anaconda strategy. We just put blockade them. Well, who says they're going to just quit? You know? Oh no, we can't import shirts anymore. Oh no, what do? We better quit or not? What's that?
I was going to say, have they quit? I still hear people in the South saying that they're going to succeed.
Yes.
So. I don't care, but you know.
Here's an element of technology that I think we don't anticipate in Stryker. And partially it was because of, certainly at the time, I didn't anticipate it. And the other thing was that if I had anticipated, I still wouldn't have done it, because there's a certain romance in science fiction that has to be maintained. A lot of science fiction games have, space fighters, because our view of war, of naval warfare, of space warfare, is a combination of, you have kind of the old school and the new school. You know, the old school is in the far, far future, space warfare is going to be like Jutland, yeah. Like the Battle of Jutland. And then the new thinkers say, no, it's going to be like the Battle of Midway, which I still think is pretty, backwards. If you ask me, I think it's going to be like ASW. That's what I think.
That's what a lot of us think at this point.
Yeah, it's going to be ASW. But the appeal of putting pilots in a single person craft is just almost irresistible. It's the whole basis of the denouement in Star Wars, it's just strapping on your engine, and going out there and doing stuff. And the truth is, I think the day of the manned piloted aircraft is over. Right now, the only thing that keeps our aircraft from having about 3 times the performance they currently do is the meat in the cockpit. Because we can do all sorts of stuff with an airplane. The problem is it kills the pilot. Just kills the pilot. The accelerations that we can have and the turning radius and everything. And the only problem has been software. And the software is kind of getting solved now in terms of having independent systems that can dogfight. The delays, the advantage of the pilot piloted aircraft over the unpiloted aircraft in terms of response is getting pretty narrow, and the performance edge is so incredible. And the other thing is that it also is liberating from the point of view of operational planning. It is people, this is not weakness, this is humanity. Humans cannot and should not lightly send their best trained, you know, pilots to their death. So if you've got a mission that's going to have a 20% casualty rate, you know, you better think real hard about that, unless all you're sending is metal.
Maybe.
If you're just sending metal and you can lose 20% of them, well, that's, you know, bill me, you know. But if you've got human beings in those, you know, in that, you know, if you routinely undertake missions like that, A, you shouldn't do it from an ethical ground. B, you shouldn't do it because it's going to ruin your force. You know, it's going to destroy the morale of your force, too. If they say, these guys are sending us on, you know, these suicide missions. I mean, let's face it. World War II, the 8th Air Force's missions, where they were taking, like, what, 5% casualties a sortie? Something like that on some of these. And those were, you know, just those were incredibly corrosive of morale. You know, 5%. With 5%, what's 5%? No problem. All you got to do is survive 30 missions. Wait!
That's 100
games. I'm not going to make it. So anyway, I think that one of the things that we didn't anticipate is the extent to which aircraft, almost all tactical aircraft, are going to be unmanned. But, and now, now the writing is clearly on the wall, and I still don't think people are going to, people are going to write science fiction games where pilots get in the cockpit and pull down the canopy and stuff, because it's just so cool.
Well, instead we're getting science fiction that warns about what an unmanned fighter might do if it gets up, if it truly gets loose.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all warning in science fiction as opposed to, ooh, what if?
Yeah, as opposed to cool science fiction, yeah.
Well, there's also the argument about detection. If it flies, it dies. And you can see it above the ground clutter while it's a target.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that goes back to the asymmetrical warfare argument, though.
Well, you always have the ethical argument, because the Air Force in particular is vulnerable to this, because you don't see the destruction from a certain height. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I was talking with guys who were World War II and 8th Air Force, and he said, you know, they were bombing Berlin and everything else, but you don't see it. They knew they were pushing the rubble around. They had an idea that, yes, we're killing people, but you didn't see that. What upset him, really upset him, is that for some reason a B-17 that still had its bombs went down low and dropped its bombs on a village that was no military target at all, and that really angered him, because to him that was killing people, murdering people, as opposed to, you know, just fulfilling your mission. So you've got that problem. And a friend of mine who was in the Air Force station in Germany was approached by a guy that was older, had been a child in World War II, and he never understood this. There was a P-51 that came over their, you know, their village. Again, it was no target, no railroad, nothing, right? And this guy dropped his bombs, wing bombs, on this town. Fortunately, didn't kill him or anything, but they took off. And the German was trying to ask, why did he do that? You know, what was the point? And my friend was trying to tell him, you have a 19-year-old pilot in a plane who's been given these bombs, and his ground crew does not want to see these come back, okay? He's not going to be rewarded by having these bombs. Oh, I didn't find a target you gave me. It's like, no, something's going to have these bombs dropped on it by this kid that, you know, has been given this mission. So, you know, this dynamic in general is difficult, and that's with a manned plane. Now put a guy in a room in the United States with a Slurpee. You know, sitting here, you know, and all these tourists looking at it says, oh, look at that. You know, are those villagers? Is that real sheep and goats, right? Done. Right?
It's just like, just playing a video game at home.
Right. He says, hurry up and kill the village because we got a meeting in 2 minutes, right? Well, what's for lunch, right? I mean, you're even more attached.
I think there's a little bit more professional.
Yes, I'm exaggerating. The whole point is that
but
you're pushing it in that
but
direction.
Certainly there's more detachment. There's more detachment. And there it is interesting, some of the things that bring you back to reality. George McGovern was a B-24 pilot in World War II. And on one of, he was flying out of Italy on the southern raids up north into Germany and Austria. They were bombing a lot of stuff in Austria. And one raid, the target was socked in, I think. But you know, they were airborne, and they got the, you know, they got the order to turn back. And so the mission was aborted. They turned back, and they you drop your and they unload the bombs over the open countryside. But you don't want to land a plane full of bombs, because if you make a mistake, well, yes, you're dead. But more importantly, there's a giant hole in the runway. You know, you just taken out your own airbase. So you always drop your bombs before you come back to base. And they're out in the middle of nowhere, and they drop the bombs. But it's a beautiful, clear day, and they can see him go down. And they watch him, and he realizes they're going to hit a farm. And I mean, it just levels this farm. And he said he felt physically sick, because it was around 12:30. Which meant that was when everybody was there having lunch. And he just killed a farm family. And he came from, you know, he was a farm boy, you know, Midwestern farm boy. And like years later, he was, you know, in Austria on, and they were interviewing him on radio. And he told that story, you know, that how really, that stayed with him like his whole life. And the radio station got a call and said, it's okay. It was our farm. We weren't there that day. Yeah, nobody was killed. Everything's fine. And we wanted to thank you for bombing those Nazi sons of bitches. You know, so that was kind of a happy ending.
Well, I want to point out from the other side of the war, I mean, people have to deal with aviators. You know, most people who have to deal with aviators tend to can view them as just ordnance. I was on Admiral staff for CAG 13 for a couple of years. And once you deal with naval aviators, especially naval aviators, it's like, yeah, load them and launch them somewhere, because I don't want to deal with them anymore.
Tail hook.
Oh, man, talk about a group of people. Whiny group of people. It's like, can't we just put them in their cases and put them away? But the point of view is, yeah, I mean, why are we sending our best trained people?
It's expensive to use human beings. And when you think about it,
it is.
Ignoring the ethical for a moment, which I can do often, if you spend that much money training a human being, if you put years into it, and then he dies on the first mission. That was a total waste. That's hideous. That's just not what you do. You want to make sure this person learns, gets better, and is able to do their job so they're extremely effective. And then you don't send them in a situation like Frank was saying, where you just spend them like they're nothing, because they're not nothing. And besides being a human being, it's an investment by your military, by your country, in this person that's hugely expensive. Why would you just throw that away? It's the opposite. It's the militia. Throw them away, you know? Yeah. You put somebody in the plane, if this is a bad mission, it's like, here, kid, just, you know, like kamikaze pilots. They didn't have to learn a lot. They didn't know how to land, and it was like they're straight and level, and they were easy to shoot down by, and they just shot down in droves, but enough got through, and that's all they had to do, right? So that's interesting. Plus,
I was just going to say that, you know, all that argument is true. I mean, I've made that argument repeatedly to people. And in science fiction, there's an enormous institutional pressure to have meat in the cockpit. It's nothing like the institutional pressure in the Air Force, though. You know, yeah, because right. The Air Force is run completely by fighter pilots. I mean, you know, if you see a guy with stars on his shoulder, you know, unless he's in some sort of weird service branch, if he's in the Air Force, he's a fighter pilot, you know, almost without exception. That is an offer to this run exclusively. And the idea that, you know, no more fighter pilots, really tough sell.
Well, I have to give the Navy that much. They, you know, stick the fighter jocks into the line to let them command anything. Mm-hmm.
Frank, you said something very interesting, but I want to bring back something you also said. One is
that wasn't so interesting.
It was very interesting, but it contradicts one aspect. Not contradicts yourself, but uh-huh. Rather talks about something, because it's contradictory in the sense that it sounds like you have developed a different philosophy. This is strategic games, okay? Mm-hmm. You told me one of your favorite games, if not your favorite game you've done, is A House Divided.
Yes.
It is the ultimate strategic game.
And it is, that's true.
And I love that game, okay? I think a lot of other people do. So it was a game you did really well. It has a lot of different aspects to it, but you also, at the time, had to figure out what are the victory conditions that we're going to put into this that are realistic for the Civil War and that challenge the players. But now you're also saying, you know, the more I think about this and the more I try to divine what are the victory conditions on a strategic level to do a World War II game or any other game or Vietnam, it's like, it's not as clear.
No, it really isn't as clear. Now, I don't have a problem with the House Divided because the course that the North embarked upon to end the war ended the war. And so it's not part of a, if you're going to do a narrative of the war, a major part of the narrative is not struggling with that issue. I mean, the North pretty much figured out, we got to take Richmond, and that's going to kind of, if not immediately, ultimately end the war, because that's where the, not just the political capital of the South, but it's also where, once you've taken out Chattanooga in that area. That's all the military industry is in this. Is it, you know, all the foundries and the cannon casting stuff? That's all in the Richmond area, Richmond Petersburg area. You take that area, and it becomes difficult for the South to wage a war from then on. So I mean that part of it is pretty clear. It's the execution of it that becomes the issue, and so you can kind of do that strategic game, assuming that the victory conditions are right. And the issue becomes how you execute. And that's really a game about execution. And it's a game about logistics and movement and that kind of stuff. That's really what... the reason I love it is because it's... somebody asked me how long it took to design that game, and it either took 3 years or a month. Depending upon how you look at it, you know? Because for like so 3 years, I struggled with all these different versions of a Civil War game. And the rules were very complicated because, you know, you've got this hex grid and you're trying to make it important to people to stay on rail lines and river lines and stuff like that. So you got these complicated logistics rules to make these things important. And finally, like one day, I was sitting on the toilet. And sometimes my greatest thoughts come to me then. And I just say, let's get rid of the hex grid. So we don't have any rules that make them stay on the rail. All there are roads, railroads and rivers. And when you do that, all of a sudden it becomes simple. When you just express the whole map in terms of communication lines and choke points. Then it got really easy to do it without a lot of complicated logistics rules. I mean, the logistics are kind of built into the map. And that, so that I love it because it's a simple solution to what had been a devilishly... And once I did that, I mean, boom, 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 it all came together real quickly. And we were playing, like, within a couple of weeks. And then a couple more weeks, that's pretty much ready to go.
So the games you're having struggle with that determine strategic objectives for was how to win the game. What are the... Can you tell us what one of those games are that you're working on that you're having the strategic...
I'm working on a series of World War II games for Victory Point Games, and after going through a lot of different ideas for a title, because it's hard to, you know, all the good titles are taken, you know, and half the titles people come up with now sound like rock albums rather than, you know, what Alan Emmerich at Victory Point Games is probably going to call this is Frank Chadwick's European Tour. Because...
I
like it too. I decided that it was that the idea of doing the whole war as this, the way it's set up is there's like, I think there's like 16 maps, but the hex grid is 100 by 100, and that covers the entire European theater of operations, and it's all with separate maps that fit together in this all the same size, so there's not like weird odd pieces. And then each map also is map or map and a half is a game. And the first game is 1938, your decision, where so it's it can be just a political game with cards, but of course you can keep playing until the politics don't work out and you've got a war instead. And it could be over the Anschluss. More likely, it'll be over Czechoslovakia. But you can end up with the Germans fighting the Czechs with the Poles as the Germans' allies or the Poles as the Czechs' allies. The Anschluss, if things go really bad for the Germans, they have to fight over Austria with Italy on Austria's side. What's that?
That's a game I'd play.
So that's so 38 is the first game and 39 is the second game, and then the Winter War is it. So there's all these games. Now the question is putting them together in terms of at the end a unified game. We're not absolutely certain we're going to do that. That's why we're calling it the European Tour.
Right.
You've got the whole thing, and when you're done, ooh, look at the maps and all the counters and everything, and you know, have fun. But this, in terms of the strategic aspect of it, one of the things I was talking to you about was struggling with this notion of national will. That really, a lot of what happens in World War II, we don't think of it in this way, but a lot of it is playing the national will game. We think of Germany as in for the long haul because they ended up that way. But along the way, they did a lot of stuff to keep their people enthusiastic about the war. Like, for example, not going to full-time war production until 1943. What they're doing before then is making stuff to keep people happy so that the support for the German people do not become war-weary sooner than they do. The U-boat war I see as an attack. I mean, one of the ways you can do it is all sorts of mechanical stuff about moving supplies and numbers and feeding people. Another way you can do it is the entire U-boat war is aimed at attacking Britain's will to fight the war. That the strategic bomber offensive, aside from the physical damage it does, is a direct attack on the German people's willingness to wage war. And all these strategic issues kind of become attempts to move this national will scale up and down, and that's what determines when a country gives up. You can overrun Yugoslavia, but if you haven't knocked its national will down, what happens? You start getting partisans, and they never go away for the whole war. So there's a lot of things that I want to do with it, and there's some things to randomize it that we talked about. But that's kind of the stuff I'm talking about there in that game. Yeah.
I'm going to actually see if we can bring the background to Stryker because I have some birdie questions.
Sure, absolutely.
I mean, it's like the decision process of how to integrate the various Traveller games. Highgarde to Traveller, we have this set of numbers in Stryker that make turrets glow like incandescent lights.
How's that?
The laser, megawatts, using megawatts for output instead of megajoules. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's left me scratching my head. Do they really mean megawatts? Is that really a light bulb up there with a laser?
Well, back when we did that, that's how laser performance was routinely described.
Okay.
Megawatts of output, not megajoules. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, if we were to do it, it would be gigawatts or gigajoules back then that was kind of in the infancy of laser weaponry, in terms of real-world laser, people talking about it, in terms of just rather than just science fiction. And the technical stuff the Air Force was doing and everything that I was working from describing this stuff was all talking about in terms of megawatt, 20-megawatt, 40-megawatt output lasers and the effect they had.
Okay, that's really the question. Uh-huh. You were just using the common jargon of the day.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of argument about what you meant sometimes with these books. It is But people are still using these rules today and arguing about.
Oh well, and with the giant room-sized IBM computers, the UNIVAC computers, from the 1950s, the really big, heavy computers.
Well, those are actually easier to explain away. You just have to point somebody at a server and you get there. You go. Assume a computer-rich environment. As your average business. Your average business today has got a closet full of computers somewhere.
A chair takes up half the time.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, And the other question is, you know, who made a lot of the decisions about projecting, you know, tech level? I know Mark has something to do with this, but how things got distributed.
The Mark did the original stuff on tech levels in the original game. I fleshed it out a lot with Mercenary. A lot of the weaponry stuff. So, and the other thing that, I mean, there's a couple things that are firsts in Mercenary, and to the best of my knowledge, it's also the first reference to a plasma weapon or a fusion weapon. You know, the plasma gun and fusion gun. Because and before that, in science fiction, it was always blasters. And I said, what is that? You know? It's not a laser. What could possibly be like a classic science fiction blaster.
As opposed to a ray gun.
Plasma gun. That'd do it. Yeah. It's something that effectively shoots a ray that explodes when it hits something. Sounds like plasma to me. So that's when we did plasma guns and fusion guns. But that stuff got fleshed out then. I'm hard pressed to differentiate between ship stuff. I think Mark did High Guard, I think, didn't he?
I believe so. I just there's sometimes little inconsistencies that people argue about with a certain amount of fervor.
Right, and the the reality is that when you do something like that, and a whole bunch of people get it, you're never going to get it completely right. If you leave it that way, people argue about it for a long time. If you change it, they hate you.
Yeah, we've seen that one too.
If you try to fix it, no one will thank you for fixing it because you broke their game.
Well, actually, you guys did it the perfect way. You let another company fix it for you, and everybody hates them.
Oh, well, that's after GDW's day, but, you know. I don't really have anything to do with the stuff with Traveler these days, so I don't really know what's going on.
I'm just kind of curious with the person in the moment and how the decisions were made. Mm-hmm. Because we've talked about it for a while. Why are we talking about this again? Let's talk about what we're fighting, not how it's, or who's fighting instead of what they're fighting with.
There's actually a symbiotic relationship between the designer and the people who play his games. Mm-hmm. And it's a hugely, because it's not one way. It isn't like, I impose this on you, and now you've got to accept it. It's like, oh no. As soon as you put it down, the playtesters are saying, why did you do it this way?
Yeah. This doesn't really work.
Right, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You got to change this. And every immediately, as soon as you do it, which is unlike a book. Because even if you have a good editor, what they'll do, they might criticize some grammar or say, this is unclear here, but what they don't do is undermine your premise or your theory or whatever you're presenting. But
some editors will.
This
doesn't work.
It's awful, that's right. But I'm just saying, in general, if you're an experienced writer and you do something like that, the editor is there to support you. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, in some respects, I think that the developers are different from the playtesters here. Developers are there to break the system if they can, you know, or the playtesters to see, can I...
Really good playtester is there to break the system.
They're there to break it if they can. If they can't, it's like, woo, pass that hurdle. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And the developer is there to take the beautiful ideas that the designer had and then combine it with the rubble that the playtesters have made of it and come up with something something that's workmanlike and
yes.
And
it's alive. No, it's not.
Not anymore.
I have a couple of technical questions.
Yeah.
What's an MHD turbine?
Magnetohydrodynamic
turbine. What do you mean? How does it work?
There was some speculative work on MHD turbines at the time. Nobody's done much with it since, and I don't really know why. But if you have a high enough velocity fluid passing over a through a magnetic field, mm-hmm. you end up getting electrical output,
okay.
Which increases the efficiency. And so, you basically you end up getting higher and higher efficiencies the faster you push the fluid through a magnetic field. Mm-hmm. And so it's you're actually lowering your power usage the higher the passage of fluids. So that's what it is. So it's basically a jet going through, doing all the stuff a normal jet does, but going through an electromagnetic field and getting a magnetohydrodynamic effect
right.
to increase power output.
Which is then generating electricity that's running the transmission that's turning the wheels of your...
Which is, yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. I think the idea is it can run both directions.
Go look at secondary.
You can either feed energy into it to get motion, or you can get it in motion and pull energy out.
Right.
And you will see that effect being used.
Okay. Yeah, it's run for October.
Yeah, run for October, but you also, if you look at natural gas power plants as a secondary and tertiary power takeoffs, which there are a few actually here in the Bay Area.
But if they don't call that, so I think a lot of this stuff's being done now, but it's not. For some reason, the term magnetohydrodynamic turbine never caught on. You know, but that's
in a war game, and that was it for the industry.
Well, it shows up, but it's usually buried somewhere in the depth of the technical information of what the effect is.
Yeah.
But they call it something else now.
And I don't really think that the efficiency gains were as much as people were speculating initially. They were expecting some really amazing efficiency gains once we got real good at this stuff. And it's been nice, but it's not like revolutionary stuff.
Pushed it to about 60% mm-hmm. at the very best.
Yeah. But that's not bad, you know.
Why don't we have graph technology yet?
What's that?
Why don't we have graph technology yet? I mean, we have lots of other stuff. It's a Tech 9. We should have graph and gravity technology by now. What happened?
What happened was... in the first edition of Traveler, that's where anti-gravity was put.
You should have put it 12.
So you need to ask Mark the question.
You have to ask someone else about that.
Where's my flying?
There was a lot of stuff in the first edition of Traveler, and I won't say they're mistakes. It's not mistakes, but I think if we'd had the experience of developing adventures and stuff and thinking through the implications on society of some of the technology, we would, if we had to do over again without any, you know, without a whole body of gamers who would kill us for doing it, we would have changed some things, you know. But again, I mean, nobody would have thanked us for changing that, you know.
They didn't.
I know that the Men in Black came to the door and said, if you put that in the game, that's it. We don't want them to know about it.
You're asking if there was something like that? No, there's something that they're not.
We know you're not allowed to tell.
That's right.
That's right.
I don't know. I'm perfectly happy that Frank and everybody wrote all these games, because not knowing the answers to some of these questions sent me back to college to get a degree. That was me taking all of calculus. So it's like I knew exactly what those numbers meant.
Uh-huh.
I know I missed something the first time I did this.
When you were setting up the design sequences for Traveler, this was before, you did that before Excel existed.
Yeah, there was some sort of database program that Mark was using. I did it all with a pen and paper myself.
Right, I mean, a huge amount of designs with pen and paper. And then I discovered spreadsheets. Mm-hmm. And also, I was doing payroll for something. Especially,
why most of my really early Stryker designs, because of the way the Stryker design sequences worked, ended up being able to do 0 to 60 in about 1.2 seconds, because you put in a power plant early, and at the end, it's like, whoa, that's about five times as much power plant as I need. What's my top speed? Yeek.
Okay, my design sequences no longer follow the design sequence in Stryker. It covers everything, but it's like, I just changed the decision-making order, and we're so, and of course the spreadsheets are just like things just get added back up and down. Really to come.
Yeah,
well, I want to thank you for that, because as a result, I'm really good at Excel.
That's a marketable skill.
It's been totally valuable.
There were some things we did early on in the design sequence. when we did Traveler, we had no expectation how far, no real expectation how far it was going to go. So we have a ship design sequence that works as a ship design sequence within the limits of what we're doing there, which is, you know, basically commercial vessels with a couple of guns on them and stuff. And so the decisions to make the drive dependent upon volume instead of mass makes it an easy system to do, but it had all sorts of implications down the road in terms of what that did to other design sequences. Because when, you know, when jump drive is dependent upon volume, not mass, it causes, and so I think are the maneuver drives. You know, the maneuver drives are based on volume instead of mass. And then, so then you get power plants later, you get these vehicles that, it just caused some interesting problems that we had to grapple with that, you know, and so not all the decisions were as elegant as I think any of us would have liked, but you can't do everything before you, you know, in an ideal world, you know, everything would be designed for like 10 years products, and then we launch, you know, but no, you, you publish the game you've got, and then you start adding to it, and that was the first role playing game we ever did, and it was only, there weren't that many role playing games in the world out at that time, certainly none that had that sort of technical design sequence in it. So I think we learned a lot of stuff, and I think probably also provided the pretty good lessons for designers that came afterwards too. You know, in terms of what to do and what some things not to do.
They oversight you. Cite you guys as one of his primary sources.
Who's that?
Dave Palmer. He's done a lot of writing for Steve Jackson and GURPS and other ones. And you and Dave Nelson get a real high on this list.
Dave Nelson was, I don't know how many of you remember Dave Nelson, but Dave Nelson was a really great designer. He's one of the greatest designers I ever worked with. He was just fucking crazy when it came to working. I mean, you'd put him to work on a project, and he'd have an article that he was going to do for Challenge Mag or for the Command Post Quarterly on modern warfare, and you got this many pages. Okay. And he'd never go beyond it, but like every draft, the typeface would get smaller. Like this thing's utterly done, like an 8-point type of the, you know, this is just jammed with stuff. You know, he just wrote, and while he was working at GDW, got tagged on the. He was the only civilian member of the U.S. Army's Armor 21 Task Force study group, so he has his Armor 21 tattoo on his shoulder. Everybody in the task force got an Armor 21 tattoo on their shoulder.
Who?
What's that?
It's universal.
Dave was a hell of a designer.
Traveler wasn't the first role-playing game that GDW did, was it?
It was the first... Well, I guess technically, no. On Guard was. But On Guard is such an odd role-playing game. I mean, I love it, but it was On Guard, I think, is still the only role... I may be wrong on this, but the only multiplayer role-playing game which does not require a referee. Hmm. You know, it's a non-refereed multiplayer role-playing game. I don't know that there are any others.
There's another one. There's one about... ancient Rome.
Is there one about ancient Rome? That's
Saturday Night or Bacchanalia. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But other than that, 821?
9 minutes,
okay. But other than that, Traveler was our first role-playing game. Unless I'm forgetting something, then I'm sure it was our first role-playing game other than On Guard.
Well, you guys were working on, what, 6 or 7 games at one time?
Oh, yeah, we always had that many in the hopper. Yeah.
I look back at the amount of travel that gets produced, then I compare it with other games like Europa.
You guys played to work, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I newsflash, designing games is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any woulda, coulda, shouldas? You know, games that you were working on that didn't make it, that you think should have made it?
If I would do anything over again, when we did Traveler the New Era, instead of doing it after the Imperium, I'd have done it in the Long Night. It would have been essentially the same game, but it wouldn't have rended the hearts of all these people who loved the Imperium, who found out that it fell. You know, and it just broke people's hearts. And that was not our intention at all. You know, the underestimated the emotional attachment people had to this fictional place, and telling them that Emperor Strephon had been killed by a computer virus really bummed a lot of people out. And that was not our intention. You know, we were just trying to have an alternate game with a much more open-ended, less structured environment. And if I had to do over again, I'd have done it in the Long Night. And had exactly pretty much the same game, but yeah, I'd have done that different.
Thank you for being here. What are you doing tomorrow, so everybody knows to? Yeah.
Tomorrow, in the afternoon, I have I'm giving a seminar on Space 1889 and all the stuff that's going on with it and steampunk. It's a steampunk world, my friends. It's a steampunk world. And then afterwards, we're maybe going to do a Space 1889 game. We had some communication problems, and so some of the soldiers who were going to come didn't come. But we may have different soldiers coming. Chris is working on that.
Okay. I have some ferocious, ugly monsters for you.
Yes, and what?
I have some ferocious, ugly monsters.
Yes, okay, yeah. Chris is telling me that you brought some ferocious, ugly. Soldiers didn't come from Rick. He kind of got focused on the other game, which is understandable. Chris is going around seeing if we can put together enough soldiers to put on a game.
Yeah, I'll be. I live just close here, so I'll be home tomorrow. I'll grab whatever I have.
Okay.
In terms of 19th century living stuff too.
I have a box this big of redoubt British soldiers. Yeah. But they're in Roseville.
Ooh.
So, yeah,
oh,
so you don't play this time. Plan A's looking much better.
Okay, well, thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Frank, would you do the honor?
Yeah,
Yeah.
You know, I almost brought my copy for exactly.
I remember.
Oh, you have one.
Woo! The Argonne Gammon and Death Station.
Yes. I'll put that in there for a reason, too.
I almost brought mine, but I didn't want to see it. How horrible a shape it was in.
I still have my own.
I said, so losing the name of the force bridge here. Capital R for
snapshot.
Snapshot. I still have the snapshot box. Contents box.
On down the road 2 years ago.
It was the hit roll table.
It became painfully obvious that a zombie highlighting had indeed been written in the 80s.
We just sort of ignore this part.
Well, it's more that it's a desperate a game that requires a referee.
Oh.
That station I didn't do, but I'm trying to get it.
Oh, my word.
Oh, that's right. We need a 2-1 to turn in once.
Doubles.
Yeah, just like the old ace double there. The ace double.
Exactly.
But I have to tell you now, my 16-year-old asked me the key question.
That was the first thing I thought of.
This week?
Yeah, 30 years
ago.
Yeah, teach me how to play Trap.
Exactly.
But he's just getting to the point where he can understand the board.
Thanks very much.
You bet. That's very cool.
I was also showing you.
The map box.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
This is, in the future, this is what greetings will look like. not exactly.
I I would want to tell you I was in the middle of the Sulu seat with the copy of that box, wishing I had one out in the middle of PBR. Going, okay, I wish we had one, so I can just go over there.
You were right. It was just the size you got wrong.
And because even now, I could see something like a map box being useful at the kernel and above.
Big fold out brief. But they're using tablets too now. So yeah, it is actually bigger than just simply a phone.
So it's big enough that you can actually look at.
But somebody is challenging Apple's patent on the iPad.
Really?
Awesome. Yes.
Yeah.
And you know on what basis? 2001 Space Odyssey.
Oh, yes!
In 2001.
I love it. Yes.
Now, I don't know if that's going to hold up in court. Does that mean if somebody has a flying car in a science fiction movie, that you can't patent flying cars? Just because they CGI'd it or, you know, done it. Yeah. But that's what, of course,
this is going to cause.
It seems the Chinese are doing challenging it anyway.
No, this is like, this was a U.S. company that's challenging. I forget who, but it was somebody else who has a patent.
They can't patent it either, but.
Just
one last question. You guys were so great when I was on the service in the 80s. Middle of the Indian Ocean, that order would be. We played more GW games. In the middle of the Pacific, where we played almost anything else.
Roger, grab his game.
I'll get into him.
And also the gentleman who we still have a thing up there. We need to turn that off.
He's coming back, I think.
I never actually bring those things anywhere.
I think he did
This is for when we're actually playing. I've just copied them. They're all out. And then I have
the design sequence tables.
Right. And then I have the terrain effects chart. So I just took the terrain effects chart. Just took the text and turned it
into a form.
And terrain is going to vary from scenarios. So I'm just going to put all those in one place. And when we actually want to get
the recorder.
Recording. Well, we're Sean.
I don't know, but is it still going?
We can turn it off.
It's an hour and a half.
I'm going to clap for you, Frank.
Okay. It clicked off on its own.